from the Bonnet College. Cavaliers first appeared in AD&D 1st Edition in Unearthed Arcana, and like many wealthy Nepo babies, were probably more trouble than they were worth. That said, they were the first class that held a built-in way to advance their ability scores when they gained levels, with all of their physical abilities having a percentile score that went up by 2d10 when they leveled. By the time 3rd Edition came around, everybody started getting ability score boosts at set levels. Thank goodness we're still not trying to make a class whose main abilities are about mounted combat working in an adventure game where mounted combat is pretty rare. We'll just save that for a subclass these days. And now we present to you Thaco with Advantage.
Welcome to Thaco with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, a whole lot of them have a family resemblance to D&D.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew. Actually, 10 years ago, I think this month, maybe last month, but either way, it's 10 years
old now. Decade.
I've been running the podcast since 2017, and in 2021, I'd been here long enough that they put me in charge of the whole stew. So there you go.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. I've been gaming since roughly 1985. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about Kobold Press's Tales of the Valiant RPG. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
I actually got to play Cygnus de Guerre, however that's supposed to be pronounced. My apologies to all the French-speaking people out there. We wrapped up our investigation into the Temple of Mystra that was a bit shady, like Goddess of Shadow shady. We went down into the lower levels and explored and quickly learned that this had never been a Temple of Mystra. There were no kidnapped hostage priests of Mystra or anything. It had always been a Temple of Shar. They had just put on the front of being a Temple to Mystra as kind of a way to lure in victims. We're fighting our way through the place. We started with a fight with some golems, and then we got into this kind of long-running fight with some shadow warriors, the head priestess, and some shadow snakes and stuff like that. It was a pretty long, drawn-out fight. There was one point where we had an anti-gravity field up on where the bad guys were, which is a standard operating procedure for this group. And we had run out of bad guys in melee range, so I was like, I'm going to do this. And I had my fighter, Selena, make an athletics check, with the GM's permission, of course, make an athletics check to leap into the anti-gravity field and end up on the ceiling so she could make an attack on the people up there. And it was pretty badass, and I was pretty proud of that. We did eventually have to argue with the cleric about how long he intended to leave up his plague of insects, since it had reached the point where, yes, it was still causing damage to the bad guys, but it was also causing damage to the good guys who couldn't really effectively do ranged combat. And we kind of, it took about two turns before we finally got him to admit that, okay, it's probably time to drop this.
You don't want bugs in your armor.
No, and they sting and they hurt. And you know, as much damage as it was doing, getting the rogue in there to do some sneak attack damage is just as effective. I have to confess that I was super tired that night for a variety of reasons. And like, yep, we're here, we're doing the things. There was actually some cool stuff going on. The Sharans had actually tried to open a permanent gate to the Shadowfell and had screwed it up. So they had to feed it victims to kind of keep it in control, which is why they were pretending to be priests of Mystra and all of that. That's where we're going to pause this campaign for a while because, you know, the GM's getting married next month and there's a lot going on, so we're pausing that one. In other news, I have been playing in Sean Kelly of Gaming and BS fame, West March's style campaign using Shadowdark. Shadowdark is a slimmed-down version of 5e to be played in a more OSR style. Right now, Sean has about 16 players, but he only takes 6 people per session. So he puts out a calendar date that a session is going to be run, and first come, first serve, people sign up for it. And people have been really great about making sure everyone gets a chance to play and all that. Like, if they've already played once, they don't sign up for another session until it's obvious the opening is valid. In the session I got to play, I played Inora, my high int, low wisdom and charisma wizard. I decided that her combination of scores means she is very capable, but is also constantly talking and has no idea when to shut up. We ended up exploring the Catacombs of the Forgotten King. We got a little bit of it explored. There were no fights in our session. We had a trap that was triggered and had to deal with the damage and poison from that. And there was a sarcophagus that was buzzing. We decided to leave that one alone. We're like, it's close to the entrance. We can hit it on the way out if we really want to. But we ended up having to leave when we went down a corridor and there was this overwhelming stench. And we had a couple of our party members get a little overwhelmed by it, i.e. they failed their saves. So we ended up, it was close to the end of the session, so we ended up deciding to leave and go home after that. I'm looking forward to future sessions of that. OSR isn't necessarily my jam, but these are good people, and it's fun to see how this type of thing is played.
Yeah, I still haven't had much of a chance. I started kind of looking at Shadow Dark, but I haven't really dug into it too deeply. Oddly, there's a few other games coming out all at the same time. So it's funny because last time we were talking about how we were having a gaming drought, and like both of us have multiple games that we're talking about this time. So I guess the drought's over.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, I did not mention my non-D&D-esque games, because we'd be here a little while longer if I was telling you about all the superhero shenanigans that have been happening. Or the science fiction shenanigans.
Well, since last time, I've had a few games, and the first one is actually, I did this like right before we recorded last time, and I didn't get a chance to mention it, but it was Brandis Stoddard's Sword of West March's game, where we're all members of a mercenary company. And basically certain numbers of the company pick up, you know, on a mission to follow up on, and then we go do the mission. It's not really hex crawling, but it is like, oh, we uncovered X, Y, and Z, so now those go on the chart as possible missions that we can take on, and that's what we do in that campaign. That's the one where I have my Githyanki Circle of Stars druid, which, again, is amusing someday. We'll explain that. So... I also had my session zero for the Curse of Strahd game that I'm going to be running monthly on Saturdays. And it went well enough that my players were going like, could we figure out another Saturday that we could play other than once a month? Which I don't want to commit to now because this has been the year of me overscheduling myself. But it's also nice that they were that excited about it after we did the session zero that they really wanted to get to playing. We spent a lot of time talking about like lines and veils and tone and content, especially since it's going to be Curse of Strahd and it's going to be a lot of, you know, horror type elements to it. We ended up with three fey adjacent characters. So one person is playing a bugbear monk, one is playing an astral elf cleric, and the other one is playing a changeling blood hunter. Because they were all fey adjacent characters, we thought this is going to be really neat. We're going to start them in the Witchlight Carnival, which is very much like a, Feywild, you know, adjacent area, and then switching it all the way over into Barovia, which is very much Shadowfell. And I really kind of like that juxtaposition of things of where we start and where we end up. So I'm also very excited about it. And then in our Midgard game, the PCs finally got their mission from Sagotan, the sea god of dragons, and it was delivered by an Anku, which is a type of celestial which looks like a skeletal dragon. But it's actually a celestial and it guides souls to the dead. And it just happened to show up and tell them where they needed to go. And also took away our grave cleric Mazrim because Brandon wants to explore a different character and we wanted to come up with a good exit. So his character has been summoned by his goddess to do things out on the plains. So it was a fun way to switch him out.
The funny thing was, is we players had no, well, Eileen probably knew, but I don't think either me or Jeremiah had any idea this was happening. And it's like, wait, where are you taking our cleric? That's our cleric. What are you doing?
I know, like staging this thing where a character got swapped out. I felt like Matthew Mercer for a minute. You know, it's like, what's going on here? But our party was filled out by a new member, which is our Ratatosk Bard, who was sent by Baldur to look over Ivy, who is, you know, like his great, great, great descendant. So now we have our tiny party member who fights with a rapier two-handed. So this is going to be fun to see.
He's kind of adorable.
The PCs had to travel through the smugglers' tunnels under Acolon, which is the city where they're at. And then they had to find a special bridge that would lead them to the Deep River Trade Outpost, which is this Underdark location that also has a connection to the Styx. The trade area is dominated by Sitar, which, long story short, they're sort of dragonborn associated with Nidhogg, but they're also kind of like bugs and they like apocalypse cults. So, you know, as you do. And then there's roachlings and Darrow and shadow goblins. And there's also a river giant. River giants in the Midgard setting navigate the river Styx and collect memories to sell them, and will also, you know, take on passengers every so often. So they negotiated with her, and she wanted to sell a bunch of the memories that she had collected, but she wasn't having an easy time selling them to anyone. So they got to decide which group of merchants they wanted to deal with. And interestingly, they picked the Darrow to deal with. One of the things, like, traditionally in D&D, Darrow for a long time have been associated with, you know, mental illness. And because of the way that Midgard explains what happens to Darrow, I kind of like putting a slightly different spin on it. And that is that because they are so worried about, like, cosmic horrors coming in and taking them over, or, you know, becoming a threat, they expose their young to, like, the void and these, you know, realms beyond reality, and it basically rewrites their brains so that they are thinking on a level to where they understand the cosmic horrors that are coming in, which also makes it seem like they don't quite connect with the real world. And I was having a lot of fun with that, and our Ratatosk managed to negotiate with them and sold them a bunch of memories, even the unmarked bottles, and everyone sailed off down the Styx. They're in view of Set's domain, and we stopped with a cliffhanger as a plague spirit, you know, hovered up out of the Styx and started moving towards the barge.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Tales of the Valiant has come out now. It was released on that weekend that they did KobolCon, and there is way too much to break down in the time that we have for an episode. So we're going to try something a little bit different. We both have our favorite classes that have stuck with us through multiple editions of the game, so instead of trying to tackle everything, we thought we'd break down what we love about them and how Tales of the Valiant handles them. So first off, we're going to take a look at one of our favorite classes. What class is it that you want to talk about first, Ange?
I would like us to start talking about the Rogue. I know this is shocking. Looking at a side-by-side comparison, progression looks to be the same for about 1st through 5th level. 6th level gets you your second bump of expertise and evasion, which I believe is moved down from 7th level in 5e. 7th level gets a new rogue, basically gets you your rogue subclass feature at 7th instead of 9th, and then reliable talent moves up to 9th level. The 10th level gets you heroic boon, which I believe all classes are getting at 10th level.
Yeah, that's a new thing that they kind of made, where it's like at 10th level, you choose X or Y for each class.
Right. So it's a choice between two different things. And rogues get the choice between escape artist, which is essentially, if I'm reading the rules correctly, evasion for other saves. Mm-hmm. It's the whatever the save is. If you have escape artist, it allows you to take no damage if you make the save, or half damage if you fail. The other option is Jack of All Trades, which gets you a bonus talent right away, and then you also get to choose from any talent list instead of just the rogue talent list. 11th level, you get a subclass feature instead of at 13th level. They take away the bonus ability improvement that rogues get at 10th level, but they still have it at 12th, as everyone gets it at 4, 8, 12, 16. One of the interesting things that I thought was pretty exciting is at 13th level, you get Precise Critical. So at 13th level, you get Precise Critical 1, and at 17th level, you get it 2. And it's essentially an improved crit range on finesse weapons, which is like, ooh, that's exciting, because you start factoring in the sneak attack damage, which is the same progression level as in 5th edition, as far as the dice you get. that can get really, really exciting. And at 14th level, you get Keen Sense, which it's slightly different from Blind Sense. It's like I looked at the two of them and they're essentially doing the same thing. They're just slightly different.
Yeah, I think they renamed it to Keen Sense so that they don't call everything where you can use a different sense other than your eyes to pinpoint things something different.
Yeah, so it's the you have senses that allow you to see when you can't see. Some interesting notes on the class. Sneak attack still says once per turn, which means the loophole is still allowed. there was some concern during the early days of the D&D Next, or whatever we're calling the current playtest that's coming out in just a couple of months at this point, where they kind of tried to take that away. I think they put it back, but it's always been considered a little bit of a loophole in that when you're playing a rogue and you go on your turn, you get to do a sneak attack. And then if you get to go on somebody else's turn with a reaction, whether it's a opportunity attack or you have a fighter in the party who can command you to take an attack or whatever, you get to have your sneak attack damage on that next roll as well. It's pretty fun, but I also don't know that that's what they intended when they initially released 5th edition, but it's become quite a beloved loophole for rogue players.
Yeah.
One thing to note on the ability score improvements that everyone gets at 4th, 8th, 12th, and 16th is it's not just 2 to any stat or a feat. It's you get +1 to any stat and you get a talent, which are kind of the Tales from the Valiant version of feats.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is, too, if you do want the +2, there are actually talents that are a +1 to an ability, but they're all like gated behind, you know, what we were talking about before with the different, like the technical talents and the combat talents and the magic talents. So if you are a rogue and you have technical talents, those bonuses are only for like intelligence or dexterity. So you're not completely wide open with the things that you advance either.
Now, they included 2 subclasses. One of them is going to look very familiar to anyone who knows 5e. It's the Thief. It's very similar. They change things up a bit with the later subclass features. It's Appraising Eye and Trap Specialist end up replacing Supreme Sneak and Use Magic Device. I think this is pretty reasonable. Supreme Sneak, okay, I mean, you're already getting reliable talent,
yeah.
And if you're, you don't really need that. You're already probably adding, at that level, I mean, you're probably already adding a +15 to your sneak roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at a +10 at the very least. You really don't need the Supreme Sneak. And Use Magic Device, that's always been very hokey. And so I think Trap Specialist ends up being a little more useful.
And it makes sense that you would know how to deal with traps if you're specializing in being a thief.
Yeah, it feels better than the 5e version. Mm-hmm. And I'll get to that in a moment. I want to talk about the other subclass they included, because that one is brand new. It's called the Enforcer. And it kind of replaces the Assassin. It's very different from the Assassin, but it is still all about you do damage. You bring the hurt down. It's all about being very brutal with your damage, and it looks very interesting. I think it's much more useful than Assassin. I very much appreciate that they shuffled around things to alleviate. And I think this was just something they did to kind of get all the classes on kind of getting their subclass features on the same level, the same progression path, because rogues had a kind of a gap there.
Oh, yeah.
You got your subclass stuff at 3rd level, and you got a lot of cool rogue stuff along the way, but you didn't get anything flavored to your subclass until 9th level.
Yeah.
And this kind of alleviates that. As far as those subclasses go, as much as I love the rogue, I didn't really want to play one until some of the extra books started coming out with additional subclasses.
Yeah.
Because the ones they had in the book were kind of not up my alley. They were kind of boring. Thief was okay. I think I made a thief once.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any interest in making an assassin. Arcane Trickster was probably the best one in there, but even that's like, eh. I like what they gave us in these two subclasses so far. It's hard to screw up the rogue. You know, honestly, the issues I had with it in 5e were the subclasses, so I think this shows promise.
I think you really hit on it there, too. Like, if you're going to tinker with the rogue, the main thing is just switching what levels things come in. Like, everything in the mm-hmm. rogue works pretty well, so you don't really want to do too much with it.
Yeah, and letting people get a subclass ability at 7th level instead of having to wait until 9th, it doesn't seem like it's that much farther, but...
It is.
It is. It really is. You are far more likely to start getting some of that flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Kazina had some nice flavor from the get-go with her soul knife, but it was like, okay, yeah, I've got this thing I do, and then otherwise than that, I'm just a normal rogue, and it hasn't been until later that I've gotten more of that flavor that I wanted.
That third level ability has to work really hard to make it feel like that subclass means anything, because it's so long before you get anything else from it.
So what about yours, Jared?
My first one that I'm going to talk about is the Bard. Because I do love bards. I do have another class that I love about as much as bards, but I also love bards.
Just as a note to everyone, he labeled them both number one in our show notes.
I can't pick between my children. So, so the first thing out of the gate that I wanted to mention about the bard is that the bard no longer has a bard spell list. You are using the arcane spell list, which is the same spell list that wizards get and sorcerers get. So that does change a little bit about the bard. What's interesting is some of this stuff doesn't look that different, but I feel like that spell list change is going to be doing a lot more than just what the structure of the class is changing. For example, I have always kind of felt like the bard is pretty close to being able to keep up with a cleric in 5th edition as far as healing goes. But in order to do that now, because you have the arcane spell list, you have... things that you get at certain levels, which are called magical secrets. I mean, this bards already had that before, but you add things to your spell list. Well, if you want to add in all of those healing abilities that you used to get, you're basically using all of your secrets on those healing abilities. So you're doing everything to get back the stuff that you didn't have. And you also won't have some staples like your second healing spell, because you can pick either cure wounds or healing word, but you can't have both of them at first level, and you're not going to get the second one until you hit 9th level. And that also means you're not going to get lesser restoration until you hit 9th level. And lesser restoration is another one of those like underappreciated spells, because it's removing conditions from you.
I have a historical question to ask. If we look at the older editions, especially first and second, bards are a different beast entirely, so we're not going to talk about them.
Yes.
But could bards be that replacement healer in 3rd edition?
No.
Or is that just something we kind of got used to in 5th edition?
It's much more of a 5th edition thing. Part of the problem in 3rd edition is, even though they had healing spells, one, they had healing spells, but they didn't get, like, 5th edition gives them things like Raise Dead. So, I mean, right there, you're changing that paradigm a bit there, too. But the other problem you have with 3rd edition is clerics could spontaneously swap out spells for cure spells, and bards could not do that. So you had to prepare that. You didn't have as many spells as a cleric. So yeah, you were not keeping up with the cleric there. And you're a lot closer to being able to do that in 5th edition.
I have always looked at, bards have always been the jack of all trades. They can do a little bit of everything. They can stand in for your arcane caster. They can stand in for a second line fighter. They can stand in for the rogue if you need it. They can do a little bit of healing. They can kind of fill a lot of gaps. I've always considered them more replacement rogues, if that makes sense.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the real problem is, first edition, like you said, we can't even compare that, because that's
you can't
a whole
even
other
talk
thing.
About that.
Second edition, bards were very weird, because they were like half rogues and half wizards, and not good at either one of them. Like, I love them. I played bards in second edition, but they weren't good at either of those things under which, but they did have neat things like, I can just roll a die and know things about things. And this is in the days when we were just getting used to the concept of having skills.
Yeah.
So, yeah, third edition is really the closest edition to fifth. And even in third edition, you know, I've talked to people about this before. Bards were your best fifth party member. They could do some neat things to support you, but if you didn't have your staple positions nailed down, they were not a good replacement for any one of those positions.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. We'll see how the spell list works out. The other thing that's a little weird about the spell list is that means that without spending any of your magical secrets now, you are a bard. You know how to sing and inspire people with your voice and also throw lightning bolts and fireballs.
I don't have a problem with that. The way you're talking about it, I can tell you have a bit of a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that.
A little bit, yeah. I think part of that is because I'm used to the idea that like things like Thunderwave literally kind of existed to give bards a more thematic area attack. Like I said, that one's really hard to read and get a feel for it, though, because that's a whole different spell list. There's a whole bunch of things swapping in and out. I don't know how it's going to feel. I just know that as far as the healing bit goes, if you want to be that healer, you're not getting all of your extra neat spells from other spell lists. You do lose Jack of All Trades, which was kind of a fun ability that, you know, just let you use, you know, your half of your proficiency bonus on things that weren't anything that you knew anything about. And the other thing that was neat about Jack of All Trades, speaking of loopholes, was it worked on initiative. But Jack of All Trades is gone now. You do now get expertise. So you get another skill where you double your proficiency bonus, which kind of makes sense for the bard. So I get it. I don't think it's a bad change. It's just, you know, it is a little bit of a bump from that idea that you're a little good at everything. Bardic performance. This is the one that I actually really am happy about, because this is what I feel like, even as much as I've liked the fifth edition bard, going back to that second edition bard, I was missing. And that is the fact that there is a thing where you could have a song going, you know, that's ongoing, that means something, that isn't just you giving inspiration to people. You're spending a bonus action on each of your turn to maintain the song, but you have two abilities that they start off with. And one is Celebrate Life. And what Celebrate Life is as long as you're maintaining your song, somebody can spend a hit die that they still have in order to, you know, get a second wind while they're listening to you.
So that works as a bonus action for the other player that can use it.
I have to look and see what action it was. I am sorry. I am terrible here.
It's okay. We can move on.
No, but I mean, it's just that, but I like that idea that you can have the song going, and if somebody wants to spend their hit die, they spend their hit die. And so it is helping bridge that healing thing a little bit, but it's also dependent on how much of your hit dice that you've been using and things of that nature. But I'm also, in general, a big fan of being able to use your hit dice more often than just in short rests. So overall, it's a good thing, I think. Cutting Words pulls that out of a subclass and makes it a ongoing bardic feature. You're still spending your bardic performances to do Cutting Words, but as long as you have your performance going up, you can do that as a reaction whenever you want to, you know, roll a d6 and subtract that from somebody's, you know, roll that they make against you.
I remember in third edition and Pathfinder specifically, there was the concept of the rolling bard song, where you would start with one song, so you have a couple of turns of something up and running, and then you switch to something else, and now you have that bonus going on, and you can kind of alternate your performance spells throughout combat to keep these bonuses up and rolling. And I kind of missed that in fifth edition. I mean, I know it could get complicated, but I kind of missed it.
Yeah, because everything really leaned heavily on the spellcasting as far as, you know, what the bard does. And at sixth level, your bardic performance gains the ability to do Clarity of Thought, which is another thing that I, you know, goes back to my second edition days. Clarity of Thought replaces Counter Charm. Counter Charm currently, when you're using Counter Charm, people get advantage on their saves against really being charmed. Clarity of Thought, actually, as long as you're maintaining the song, if they are within the radius of your song, which is like 30 feet to start, and it goes up to 60 when you're higher level, but if they're within 30 feet of you and you're doing Clarity of Thought, they can't be charmed, which I like that. You know, it's basically they are more interested in what you're saying than whatever anybody else is saying. We mentioned this before, but Magical Secrets, you get that at 9th, 13th, and 18th, and that's where you get to pull a spell into your spell list that does not exist on the arcane spell list.
I think this is why I don't mind them having access to Fireball or Lightning Bolt, because this is where I would get Fireball or Lightning Bolt.
I understand that. And I mean, depending on what you want to do, this is also where you could make your bard a little more druidic if you really want to get first edition involved in there too.
Does anybody really want to do that, Jared?
I don't mind the feel of the druidic thing. I don't want to go through the, you're a fighter, you're a thief, you're not good at anything. again, at 10th level, you get that heroic boon. So you are picking between two separate things that replaces the expertise that you would have got at this level, but you got it a lot earlier this time around. And when you get to grand performance, your performance area goes from 30 feet to 60 feet. So, you know, people don't have to stick quite as near you. And then for your epic boon, which is at 20th level, when you, you know, when you get a big special things, you can use a bonus action to give yourself a number of bardic performances back. You can only do this a certain number of times per, I think is proficiency bonus number of times. But that means like every time you have a bonus action, if you just want to keep cranking up how many bardic performance dice that you still have, you can just do that for, you know, like three times in a row in a combat and have a ton of them.
I have to confess, I didn't look at the epic boons for the two classes I covered because I'm like, I'm never going to get there.
Our entire concession here is this is a massive rule set and we are just starting to scratch the surface of it. So there was another interesting thing, though, that I wanted to bring up, and that is there is a conversion guide from 5th edition to Tales of the Valiant. And bards, if you notice, have one less subclass ability than most other classes have. So what they did in that document is they gave you a generic 10th level ability that you can have if you are using a subclass that does not have a 10th level ability or an 11th level ability. Sorry. What that's going to do is you roll twice and take the better whenever somebody uses your inspiration. It's not major, but it's something to fill that gap. If you still want to use something like from Tasha's or something like that with this version of the bard, it's still filling that gap with something and saying, okay, you don't just deal with not having an extra subclass feature.
That's more powerful than you think, being allowed to roll the dice twice and take the results you want. That's pretty powerful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I like the ability. It's just, it's not keyed to the flavor of any subclass, but it is saying, here, take this, because you don't have something in this slot. I am definitely still interested in playing a bard. I just don't quite know what it's going to feel like having a different spell list. And it might be that instead of defaulting to being almost as good as a cleric, it may default as being almost as good of a battlefield controller as a wizard or a sorcerer, depending on how you view things. I would just have to kind of see.
Yeah.
Okay, so variety is the spice of life. So let's look at another favorite class from each of us. What is your number two or number one point B? What class would you like to talk about this time around?
I'm going to talk about the sorcerer because I love my naturally gifted casters. So with sorcerers, it swaps sorcerer's origin and font of spellcasting. It gives you font of spellcasting at first level, which means you automatically start with sorcery points, which in fifth edition, you don't right away. Mm-hmm. You get your subclass at third. You start getting metamagic at second level instead of third. Basically, things got shuffled around pretty significantly for sorcerers. One of the things I am super excited about is at fifth level, you get Sorceress Renewal, which is essentially you get to roll a d4 and you get that many sorcery points back, which I'll talk about this a little later, but I have thoughts on sorcerers. At sixth level, you get more metamagic. At seventh level, you get a subclass feature instead of at sixth. You get a stronger Sorceress Renewaler at 9th. 10th, your Heroic Boon is a choice between Arcane Instruction, which lets you add your Charisma modifier to a failed ability check, or you get to choose Innate Spell, which allows you to gain a new spell that can be cast with sorcery points. And I believe that spell can be from different spell lists, but don't quote me on that.
I could see that working, though, because if you're a sorcerer, you are kind of pulling in magic that isn't necessarily from that silo.
Yeah, it allows you to be like, I just absorbed this. I watched so-and-so cast this so often, now I can do it. So there. 11th level, you get your subclass feature up from 14th. 13th level gives you more metamagic and Sorceress Renewal 3. 14th level gives you something new. It's called Devour Spell. I love this. It basically lets you absorb spells and magical effects. And then 15th level gives you more another subclass feature up from 18th. 17th is Sorceress Renewal 4. 18th level is more metamagic. This is where I'm going to talk about the nature of sorcerers. In third edition, the difference between wizards and sorcerers used to be that sorcerers had a very limited spell list, which was always known, but you had more spells to cast. Whereas wizards could have almost an unlimited number of spells they knew, but they had to choose which ones they had prepared, and they had fewer that they could cast per day. They did away with this in 5th edition, and they replaced those extra spells with sorcery points, which, I mean, okay, that seems like it's fine, until you realize they also gave wizards arcane recovery, which means on a short rest, wizards can regain spells, which sorcerers can't do. Yes, you can convert sorcery points into spell slots, but that means you're not using your sorcery points to do your metamagic. And as a result, I felt like it kind of nerfed sorcerers a little bit. Not enough that I don't think they're fun to play, but it definitely meant like the people who were the serious gamers who were like all about being the most effective in combat, they're never going to look at a sorcerer. They're always going to look at a wizard because you have an unlimited options for the spells you can have available. And you have more spells to cast because you've got arcane recovery. So with the sorceress renewal, I think that can help a little bit. You know, it's only, I believe it's only a D4.
You can do a lot with sorcery points. So.
Yeah, you can do a lot. I mean, most of the metamagic is, you know, 1 or 2 points to do the metamagic, and metamagic can be super powerful. Now, the subclasses. Just like the rogue, there's one that's familiar. Actually, both of these are familiar, but one of them is gloriously different. They've got the draconic subclass, and it seems pretty close to the one from 5th edition. There's a couple of little changes. Imperious Wings is a rename of Draconic Wings. I don't think it's dramatically different. It's just got a little bit of a flavor change. And then Draconian Vengeance replaces Draconic Presence. It's like one of the nice things about that is it doesn't use sorcery points, and it seems to be a little more active, which at the level you get Draconian Vengeance or Draconic Presence in 5th edition, I think it's more useful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Chaos Magic replaces Wild Magic. And since I play a Wild Magic Sorcerer, despite those gamers telling me that's not efficient, I'm super excited about this because Volatile Magic replaces the Wild Magic Surge. Now, in 5th edition, what happens is when you cast a spell of first level or higher, you roll an additional d20. If you roll a 1, you have to roll on the Wild Magic Surge table. And the group I play with, we ended up house ruling this. And the funny thing is what we house ruled is actually very similar to what Volatile Magic is. Because in this one, now, any first level spell or higher, you roll that d20, but you're rolling against a DC. And that DC is your spell level plus your sorcerer level minus a d20. So if you are a first level sorcerer casting a first level spell, your DC is an 18. Now, the one thing I couldn't figure out is if hitting it means the wild magic happen, the chaos magic happens, or getting under it. I believe it's hitting it or above the chaos magic happens, which makes more sense. Because the whole idea is the more powerful the spell you use, the more likely you are to have some wild magic happen. In the game I play with my sorcerer, Dove, we pretty much did this. Not quite. Basically, it's instead of rolling a 1, it's you have to roll, if you roll under the spell level. So if I cast a 6th level spell and I get a 5, wild magic happens.
Mm-hmm.
Also, one of the interesting things is if you have 0 luck when you do this, you get to roll twice and take the higher result. It kind of forces you into having more of that wild magic happen, because you're rolling with advantage against yourself. It's pretty wild.
It might be worth touching on luck, since I think we've talked about it on the show before, but luck is what Tales of the Valiant replaced inspiration with.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time you miss an attack or a save on a turn, you get a point of luck. You can spend luck 1 for 1 to add to a roll to raise it, Or you can spend 3 luck to reroll a die. And if you hit 5 luck, you can only have 5 luck. And if you go past that, then it resets and you have to roll a d4 to see how many luck you have again afterwards. It is a little bit more fluid than inspiration is. And it's also a little less DM figure out what good role playing means in this situation and how often somebody's actually going to use it.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other things I'm really excited about is the volatile magic table is completely different from the wild magic surge table.
Mm-hmm.
I think the options they are presenting are more interesting. And while some of them can still be dangerous, I don't think it's as obnoxious as the 5e table, because the 5e table, you could be a first level sorcerer and end up bringing a fireball down on yourself and your party and cause a TPK. There's still some dangerous things that can happen with the volatile magic table, but some of them are just interesting. Like, your hair falls out and takes the vague shape of an animated sword. The sword follows you and defends you until it is reduced to 0 hit points, at which point the hair scurries off, now free. Your hair will regrow normally. I'm like, that's glorious.
Yeah.
One of the other ones. You and each creature within 20 feet of you are instantly dressed in fine clothing worth a total of 100 gold pieces. You're in the middle of a battle in a slum in the city, and all of a sudden everyone looks like they're going to the fanciest party at the palace. I mean, like, that is wild magic at its core. I love this table. As you get higher levels in chaos magic, you get some other abilities. Embrace Chaos allows you to purposefully roll on the volatile spell table as a bonus action with yourself as the target for whatever spell. But on an even number, you gain a proficiency bonus worth of sorcery points back. And if it's odd, you can get a con score worth of temporary hit points. Inflict Disorder lets you, again, roll on the volatile magic table when you are the target of a spell or attack. And then finally, Apotheosis of Discord lets you become a conduit for magic if you cast a 6th level spell or higher. I'm not 100% sure what that actually means in gameplay, but it sounds amazing. I'm so excited with this. I am half tempted to go to my GM for the City of Cowls game and go, here, look at this. Look at this.
And honestly, I was just going to say, too, if you don't want to adopt luck, it's easy enough to say that that same thing triggers if you have inspiration or you don't have inspiration.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really easy fix there. Just listening to you talk about this and looking at this, wild magic sorcerers never really excited me that much. I like the concept, but it's never really seized me as something I wanted to play in 5th edition. I think part of that was the rules are also real fuzzy on it, where it's like, yes, if you roll a 1, this happens. Also, sometimes when the GM says so, maybe you should roll again. And it's like, I don't like that. It was like real fuzzy.
I've had a lot of fun with it, but it's because I'm in a good game with a good GM and other players, and we can lean into some of the weirder things. But we very quickly learned that if we didn't adjust how wild magic happens, it was barely ever going to happen in game.
Yeah.
I think until we switched to the method we're using now, I had it happen maybe twice from 2nd level to 6th level. I summoned a unicorn once, and I gave myself immunity to alcohol for 3 days. And I mean, both of those were fun, because the unicorn was full of sass and annoyed that he'd gotten pulled away from wherever he was. And the immunity to alcohol let me basically have drinking contests with a bunch of Vikings in the bar and drink all of them under the table. It let me gain their respect. They think the world of Dove now.
So, should I talk about my other number one?
Yeah, tell us about your number one pick, Jared.
Okay, the other class that I dearly, dearly love and have since the very beginnings of the game is Ranger. I love Rangers, and I will also very clearly state this. When I'm thinking of Ranger, my archetype is Aragorn. That's, you know, very much what I am thinking. And I know D&D has added lots of weird stuff that is not Aragorn-y, but it's okay. I've grown to love those things as well. But I also feel like The 5th edition Ranger was not perfect. They overbalanced it by giving it a little bit too much stuff where it's like, hey, here's stuff in the exploration tier that you can do and not anything to balance out that you're not as good as fighters or paladins at doing some of this stuff. And the other problem with that is a lot of the stuff they gave them for the exploration tier was just, hey, you can't get lost. Like, not you're better at avoiding getting lost. You just can't. And I don't think it's a lot of fun when you just take something away and say, it's not a problem anymore.
It's basically telling GMs, you're never allowed to have a they got lost storyline.
Yeah.
Any plan you had for that being a potential possibility in a campaign, just forget about it because it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, and then it doesn't feel like something that your ranger actively does. It just feels like something you have removed from the campaign.
Yeah.
So it's less a thing that you're good at and more something you told the GM to stop doing.
And I mean, like, honestly speaking, even a ranger in a strange land that they have never been to before, especially if there's a lot of other stuff going on, should stand the possibility of getting lost.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, they'll keep you alive while you're lost, but
mm-hmm.
You're still lost.
So the Tales of the Valiant Ranger, it replaces Natural Explorer, which is where we're talking about some of these issues coming from, with Explorer. And what Explorer does is you have either a climbing or a swimming speed, which means like you aren't moving at half your normal speed when you climb or swim, and you aren't making any ability checks, which, yes, that does, you're not making a roll, but it's a movement rate. It doesn't bother me as much when you're taking a roll away when you're giving somebody a movement rate. They have advantage to tracking, which is very much a ranger thing, and they are not slowed by difficult terrain at all. And I like all of this. A lot of the terrain stuff used to get tied up in favored terrain, and favored terrain was one of those things where it's good sometimes, but only if you're in the right terrain and you picked it. And I just like this idea, like rangers just don't get entangled in stuff when they're moving.
Favored monster and favored terrain have always been things that sound good on paper, but end up being kind of useless at the table, unless you've got a GM who is consciously working to make sure you're getting to use those abilities.
Yes, definitely. The other thing that I'm really happy about with this ranger is Mystic Mark replaces Hunter's Mark. And you may say, wait, Hunter's Mark is a spell. Yes, Hunter's Mark does not exist as a spell in this rule set, and rangers just get to mark prey as a class ability.
As it should be.
Exactly. It makes no sense. Even when they put it on other classes' spell lists, it didn't make any sense for those other classes because this was supposed to be a ranger thing, so I am super happy with this. When you hit somebody, you can enact this. You get to do it a proficiency bonus number of times. It does a similar amount of damage, you know, extra damage like you would do with Hunter's Mark. But also, it is not a concentration spell. It's just an ability, which means if you are a ranger and you fight up front, you aren't making concentration saves with your crappy spellcasting stat because you aren't going to have a good spellcasting stat if you're a ranger.
Thank God.
Yes, I'm very happy with that change. The martial actions are a thing that have changed in most of the frontline fighters, which is, you know, it's what fighting style used to be. But the way they've redesigned it is most of these martial actions now, it's a bonus action that you have to take to boost some other ability to show that you're skilled in that thing. So it's basically trying to make them seem a little bit more active than just a passive thing that they have, even though they do some similar things. And what the ranger gets is two weapon fighting, which deals with your bonus action, but it's just basically saying, you know, with your bonus action, you can attack with your offhand and it's fine. But the other one is archery. And archery, your martial action is aim, which lets you double your proficiency bonus on the next attack you make after you use that bonus action.
I gotta say, I dearly, dearly miss the OP 3rd edition ranger. I loved playing my archery ranger because I was death on wheels in combat. And it was part of the reason why I was really disappointed in the 5th edition ranger, because mm-hmm. you can't even get close to that. I think the Gloomstalker gives you a little teeny, teeny bit mm-hmm. on some of the things it does for you, but I miss being a badass ranger with all the happy feats of double shot or whatever they were.
I like these. My biggest problem is you only have two weapon fighting or archery.
Yeah.
So you're even more locked into you are an archer or you're Drizzt than you are in the fifth edition fighter. I really think they need other martial actions. And my only proof for this is to say Aragorn's got a longsword.
Yeah.
Doesn't have anything in his offhand.
Like, standing in the foreground of this class, you see Legolas on one side and Drizzt on the other. And then in the background, in the shadows, way behind everyone, forgotten by all of the designers, is Aragorn.
Aragorn calling back from back there, I'm the reason you get a bonus on tracking. Anyway, I like those. I am kind of curious to see what doubling your proficiency bonus does to bounded accuracy, but also you're spending a bonus action to set it up and you only get it on your next shot. So even if you have multiple attacks, you know, as you get higher level, it's on that first shot.
I don't think it'll be too bad. Any character who has expertise is already doing that on the skill checks.
Yeah, it's just, it's not something you usually see in combat.
No, it's not something you usually see in combat, but I don't think it'll be that bad.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those things I need to see it in play, but I don't hate it. You no longer get primeval awareness, and I would complain, except I don't care about primeval awareness. This and the paladin ability, they're so situational, where it's like, either you're asking the DM to remember if he put something in an area where it's like, oh crap, they should have remembered there's a fiend over here, or there's, you know, they should have known there's a dragon over here. Or you, as the player, knows that, yes, this is a thing that's in the adventure and it doesn't do you any good. It's just there somewhere within the range of your ability. So I don't care if primeval awareness goes away.
This is a little off topic, but I know in the games I'm in where we have a paladin, people are usually like, can I just try and, you know, sense if there's any danger instead of sense evil?
I want my spider,
whatever
sense.
It is. It's like, and it's like, I get that the detect evil the paladins used to have back in the day was extremely abused and a problem and usually ended with immature players starting to slaughter the townsfolk because the barkeep was evil or whatever. But they kind of went in the opposite direction and made it so useless or so situational that it wasn't worth taking anymore.
So when rangers get their spells, because rangers are still a spellcasting class, we're not drifting that far from core 5th edition here. When you get your spells, they come from the primordial spell list, which is the same thing that druids are getting their spells from. Now, again, because this is a broad spell list and not tailored to an individual class, that does mean there are some interesting things like rangers having access to Burning Hands, Thunder Wave, Moonbeam, Call Lightning, some more overt calling down the heavens to smite people spells than they used to have. There's also a lot of the spells that used to modify archery, like, you know, splitting your arrows into multiple things and conjure barrage and things like that, aren't on the list anymore. They're just gone. And part of that, I think, makes sense because it's not really a druid thing to be able to fire an arrow up in the air and have it turn into, you know, a barrage of arrows. So I get it. I don't hate it one way or the other. It is part of my ongoing thing where I need to see what these broad spell lists feel like in play. I am very much focused on spells should be supporting what the ranger does, and what the ranger does isn't very nice. Sorry, no. What the ranger does is hunt things. Empower Mark, you get later on, and I like this one too, because if you have someone marked, they cannot get advantage on you if you don't know where they're at, and you don't lose track of where they're at. Now, that doesn't mean you see them. Like, if they go invisible, you don't see them, but you know where they're at, so you still can attack them with disadvantage without having to, like, roll a check to try and pinpoint where they're at. You generally know where they're at. If they have that benefit, you still have that. So, but also, if they're invisible, they're not sneaking up on you. You know they're out there, so they don't get advantage on you. And I like that, because that is very much a hunter thing. Like, I know this is my prey. They're not getting the drop on me. I like that. Stalker's Step is, in any dim light or obscured area, you just go invisible. There is no worrying about the ins and outs of how they were explaining, like, camouflage or hide in plain sight or anything. It's just, hey, you don't have to be completely out of someone's line of sight. It just has to be a little hard to see you, and you can go invisible. And you can do that proficiency bonus number of times per long rest. You do lose hide in plain sight and vanish, but this is, like, better than both of those, so I'm fine with that. You get keen sense out to 10 feet. Not a really long range, but, you know, it's something. Strider, which, you know, I wonder where they came up with that name from. no one gets to roll opportunity attacks against you, no matter how you're moving, and you have advantage on any effects that you have to save against that would hold you in one spot. So it's making the ranger a lot more mobile at that point.
I like that. I think I like that.
Mm-hmm. The big capstone at 20th level is Foeslayer, which is exactly what it used to be, except at 20th level, it was so sad because you would get a bonus to damage once per turn when you were attacking something that you had marked. This is your 20th level ability. And now it's saying, no, you get that bonus to damage every time you hit them because this is your capstone ability. If you have them marked, you're getting that bonus damage.
Yeah.
20th level abilities are weird anyway, but some of them just felt really underpowered compared to some of the other ones. So the other thing that kind of amused me about Rangers is if you read the conversion guide and everything they're talking about, this moves up to here and this moves to here for all the other classes. Rangers have exactly the same subclass progression that they have always had. Rangers are just standing here going, guys, I don't know what you're talking about. Everything's the same. But yeah, in general, I like that it doesn't negate anything to give you something. You're just good at making certain checks. I like how they juggled some similar abilities that are just clearer to understand into things. Hunter's Mark being a ranger ability makes so much more sense. My biggest thing is just, what does it feel like when you have that broader spell list? And please, somewhere down the line, give them a few more fighting style replacement things that aren't just archery and two weapon fighting.
Now, did they completely take away favorite enemy?
Yeah, that's not a thing.
Like I was saying before, the flavor seems good, but it ends up being kind of useless.
Yeah, I mean, and the whole point is that you are a hunter, and once you have hit something, you have an idea of how to fight them, so you're good at doing it from then on. And I like that as the replacement ability, other than, I hate that thing so hard I do extra damage to it.
Can't tell you how many rangers I have played where I have a favorite enemy and then never, ever, ever fought that enemy.
Yeah. And third was terrible about that, too. I mean, that one was real rough.
Yeah.
Fifth, at least, you barely got anything worthwhile with favorite enemy anyway, so you didn't feel that bad about it.
But I got to the point where I would ask a GM, hey, what are we going to be fighting? Give me a ballpark so I can take favorite enemy and actually be useful.
But then the problem becomes there is, okay, eventually, giants are a big thing in this campaign. But if I take it now, it's not going to do me any good for how many levels, because I really hope we don't start fighting giants at second level. Okay, since we're both DMs, in addition to being players, I thought we might look at some of our favorite monsters too, or at least a monster that we thought would be interesting to take a look at in these rules. So since the Monster Vault came out, what's one of your monsters that you looked at, and how does it look in Tales of the Valiant?
I ended up looking up the Clay Golem, because I have a deep fondness for Clay Golems since my players one-shot at a Clay Golem in an Eberron Pathfinder campaign many years ago. It was a situation where they had time to prepare. They knew what they were doing. I've told this story many times. The monk ran in, did flurry of blows, did, you know, under 10 points of damage. The cavalier ran in on his steed, which was a tiger, and hit it once. And then the gunslinger went and critted and did 88 points of damage in one hit, and the clay golem fell apart. Like, the other three members of the party were standing out in the hallway going, wow, well done. So ever since, I have had a fondness for clay golems. As far as I can tell, looking at it in Tales of the Valiant, it's pretty much almost exactly the same. Same AC, same stats, same speed, most of the same abilities. It has more hit points, which I think is pretty typical coming from Kobold Press.
Yeah, a lot of them got bumped up.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea, because my experiences as a GM in 5th edition is that competent players mow through things way quicker than you think they're going to.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of boggled a bit that they gave the Clay Golem two skills, one of which was perception and the other was stealth.
I think that's a standard, though. I think they give you the passive for both of those for every monster.
Okay.
So even if it's not something they would normally do, I think that's just a normal thing that they put in the stat block, whether you are trying to hide from it or it is trying to hide from you. It's giving you that static number.
That makes way more sense, because I'm like, the golem has stealth?
Surprise!
They did have an interesting ability on the Tales of the Valiant version that is not in 5th edition, and that's called Mold Hand, which lets the golem mold their hand into a weapon that then does that weapon's type of damage. So instead of just doing bludgeoning damage with their fists, it can form its hand into a longsword and now be doing slashing damage on its targets, which is pretty cool and, you know, would allow for letting the golem adapt to whatever it's fighting. Oh, this thing was resistant to bludgeoning, so now I'm going to try and stab it.
It's also, since we have to get our obligatory comic book reference in here too, it kind of reminds me of Clayface from Batman too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's very Clayface. If you get the Harley Quinn reference without the acting ability.
I love that version of Clayface.
I have friends who have a recurring Mutants and Masterminds game that is the Harley Quinn cartoon. And my one friend plays Clayface with all of the over-the-top acting can imagine.
Well, I looked up the Aboleth mainly because it was still in my head that when I wanted to use an Aboleth in our Thursday night campaign, I looked at a lot of different versions of it because the 5th edition one just wasn't quite doing it for me, especially remembering what older editions of the Aboleth did. And now that I look at this one, I would have used this one just flat out. The one that I used, I actually took from the Level Up 5e books, and it was okay. It worked mostly, like it was like 95% of what I wanted. This one is just about exactly what I had in mind, and it does some things that I didn't think I wanted, but I know that I want now. So first off, it has more hit points, which, like we said, it's a kobold press thing. Basically, you know, a lot of things go down too easy for their challenge rating. I actually agree. And it's also, when we say more hit points, it's not like they're glomming on like 50 or 60. It's more like 20. It's not a ton more. The ability score line is interesting because now they do kind of roll in what their save bonus is onto some of those instead of listing out all of their skills and saves. So like if somebody gets their proficiency bonus plus their ability bonus, it's just in that stat line under strength and it might say +9. So you're just rolling a +9. And it's kind of up to the GM to decide whether they have a skill that goes along with some of those things too, which is interesting. The only reason I bring that up here is that loses the Aboleth some of their skill bonuses because Aboleth had some weird, you know, intelligence, knowledge skills that their roles aren't as impressive now the way they do the stat block line. But that's not that hard to deal with. I mean, I'm usually not rolling in the middle of a fight to see whether an Aboleth knows something or not, so I'm okay with that. They did get resistance to acid, which makes sense because they're slimy psychic fish with tentacles. They're also now immune to psychic damage, which I love this, but I have probably two people in the party that would have really been pissed off at me if I used this version of the Aboleth.
I would have been so pissed. I would have been absolutely livid with you, Jared.
This one, they have like a lot of their abilities are listed under aberrant resilience, which is what a lot of aberrations get. And that gives them resistance to mental effects and anything that forces them to shape change. Basically, because aberrations are so weird, it's hard to change them into something else. That's kind of the logic there.
I get the psychic immune to psychic damage, but at the same time, different games, but it completely screws over all of the psychic classes.
Yes.
Sorry, Xena's weapons are made out of her mind.
Yes.
They do psychic damage.
That is that juggling between this makes sense thematically and also it's going to screw two of my party members.
You know, I wouldn't mind, like I would probably be okay with resistant to psychic damage where it's like you're still hurting it, but it doesn't seem like you're hurting it as much as you should be.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. I am happy. Aboleth already had legendary actions, but they didn't have legendary resistance. So now they do, and I'm happy about that because that makes sense to me that if your Aboleth is going to be your boss monster, that it's going to be able to like make a few of its saves if your dice hate you that night. Slime Pox replaces Mucus Cloud. Mucus Cloud, if you ever read the ability, and I know it doesn't make you want to read the ability when it has a name like that, but it is another one of those situational things where if X happens, they can release it, and it affects people under these circumstances. It's not fun because there's too many things to keep track of, like when it can actually happen. Slime Pox is just if you hit an Aboleth with a melee weapon and you're within 5 feet of it, or if it hits you with a melee attack, you have to save against this. And if you fail to save, you start doing that thing, which is very traditionally an Aboleth thing where they start turning you into something with gelatinous skin that has to live underwater and is completely beholden to the Aboleth. And what's interesting about that is this Aboleth does not get any charm abilities or suggestion or anything like that. If it's going to take you over, it's going to take you over by infecting you with this. And I kind of like that a little bit better.
I think that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And it also, it ups the horror aspect of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not just that you're being charmed into doing something you don't want to do. You know that this is happening to you and, you know, is changing you and oh, crap.
Yeah, you are turning into a different life form at this point. So it got rid of the enslave ability. It gets psychic torrent now, which is another thing I kind of like, which is it is a ranged attack. It's not quite as effective as its tentacles, but it also means that if your Aboleth swims out into the middle of the lake to get away from the PCs, it can still attack them. It's not having to choose between, can I attack them and put myself at risk or, you know, give myself some distance. So I like that too. And I like that it doesn't quite do as much as the tentacles. You know, it's not like it's a, an awesome option, but it is an option.
Yeah.
One of its legendary abilities, and this is something that's happened with a bunch of monsters, is a bunch of monsters used to have the ability where they could spend a legendary action and roll a check to see if they could pinpoint something that was hiding from them. Most of those legendary actions now just say it spends a legendary action and it knows where everything is at. And I kind of like that if it's a legendary monster. I don't necessarily want every monster to be able to do that, but I kind of like the idea that it's using its legendary action to go, okay, where are you at? You know, trying to figure that out. And it doesn't feel like a waste because they didn't roll high enough to figure it out. Swim is one of their legendary actions now. You don't get an opportunity attack. They can just swim away from you. And Slime Drain replaces the other ability they had, which is they had to have you charmed in order to drain life force off of you before. Now, if you are infected with the slime pox, they can use two legendary actions to drain hit points off of you. And I like that. Then the lair actions, these are kind of neat because there was a lair action that let them cast Phantasmal Force on someone. And that is still sort of here, but now it is a specific thing where they show you this weird alien world and you get mesmerized by seeing this landscape in a different alternate reality. And I love that so much more than just saying you can cast Phantasmal Force on someone. And then their other lair actions are the water turns into tentacles and holds PCs in place, or it sends out this big pulse of fear and psychic damage.
This sounds more thematically appropriate to what an Aboleth should be.
It was really weird because I felt like I was fighting. I was swimming upstream with my weird, you know, slime tentacle fish, trying to get it to feel right. And this one just feels right. The more I was reading through, I was like, oh, man, yeah. I love this. I wish I had this when I did that encounter. The only thing about organization is I'm not sure they did this thing where, like, third edition used to have this thing where all aberrations have these immunities. So if it's an aberration, it's not even going to say it's immune to these things. It's just, you know, this. They've kind of moved back towards that in Tales of the Valiant, except they don't just say all aberrations are immune to this stuff. You'll have to remember it. We're not putting it in a stat block. It's in the stat block, but it's like the first thing in the stat block. But I think I would still rather have those things on the immunity and resistance lines instead of down lower in the stat block.
I had the same thought about the Clay Golem because I think we talked about this off show where it doesn't say in the stat blocks for any golems that they're vulnerable to adamantine.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a thing that's listed as something that constructs are vulnerable to. So you have to look elsewhere to know all the things. Like, I would rather just give it to me all in one spot.
Yeah.
Give it to me in this. I'm not looking elsewhere when I'm running this creature. I'm looking at this stat block to run it. You know, and I hate having to pull other information from other places.
That is one of the biggest things that I think was a big, huge benefit of fourth edition when it came to monster stat blocks is when you were running a monster, you were looking at that stat block and that's it.
Yep.
Honestly, I'm pretty happy with this version. I think they did a great job with this version of the Aboleth. They like reached inside my head with their psychic abilities and tore loose the perfect monster that I had been envisioning. So I'm happy with that.
That's creepy, Jared.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad this wasn't out there when we fought it, because I would have been very mad as a player and Kazina would have been very upset and we probably would have died because, yeah.
But you wouldn't have had that moment where you were afraid that Marin was going to turn around and start hitting you all with a sword. I am going to say I am very sad for my other wayward child. I did want to talk about the Frost Giant. not going to dive into that too much because we've been talking a lot, other than to say the giants aren't just a sack of hit points, which a lot of giants, their stat blocks were very, very similar. And these are still kind of a sack of hit points, but they're not as similar. So I'll say that much and, you know, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll confess I didn't have as much time to dive into the monsters. So I basically was like, what's a monster? I'm like, a clay golem. I'll look up the clay golem. So I didn't peruse through the options to see what they had out there.
Yeah. I will say, though, I mean, even if you don't want to adopt the new classes or all of that stuff from Tales of the Valiant, you can use these monsters in 5th edition very easily.
Yeah.
And since the Monster Vault is redoing a bunch of classic 5e monsters, if you do want the standard 5e monsters, but they hit a little harder and have a few more hit points, this is a really good resource to use for that.
I'm pretty excited about it. I don't know that I will be transitioning any of my campaigns to this, but I could see trying something with it in the future. Especially since, as far as I know, these rules are going to be available on Shard, which I like running my D&D games in.
Yeah, in fact, if you go there right now, even without paying for anything, you can load the Black Flag reference document in, and that's got most of the monsters and the classes and one of the two subclasses in it. So you actually can play around with it right now.
No time for us, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
So getting us out of here, every episode we're going to look back for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. I already shared this on the Gnomecast, but I wanted to share it here as well. I recently came across this slightly older blog article, 2021, talking about the six cultures of play. Now, it's not pretending to be a hard and fast diagnosis of RPG culture, but it does break things down in a way that makes sense. Most people are going to be a mix of these in the way that they play and the games they enjoy, but it's fascinating reading them and seeing how the culture has shifted in role-playing games over the evolution of this hobby. I have always considered myself a fairly trad GM, but upon reading it there, a lot of the definitions of trad was that the game is GM-focused. Like, it's all about what the GM wants, it's the GM's world. The players are just there as guests. And that's not the way I play. So I was like, well, that's not me. So I'm not sure I fully agree with this definition. But when I started looking at some of the others, I realized I'm probably a blend of a foundation of trad, but then adding in flavor from story games and kind of what he was referring to as the modern play OC, which I think refers to an original character. The other term was neo-trad, which I'm like, that just sounds weird. I'm not going to use that one. But it basically makes the focus is on the PCs rather than just the GM's world. And he was kind of looking at it like it's the influence of Critical Role and that type of thing on the way games are played and the way players engage with the game focused on their character. And definitely like that story game flavor. I definitely not am a pure story game person because there's just stuff I chafe at in a pure story game sense. I've run many of my story games with a little bit more of a trad feel. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's played any of my Powered by the Apocalypse games might be able to tell that, but then they may not. I don't know. Anyway, I'll have a link to this article in our show notes.
I was just going to bring up, if you haven't heard about it yet, Critical Role has a new service called Beacon. And if you're wondering why they would do this, a lot of it has to do with the fact that YouTube and Twitch are changing a lot of their policies and they're making it harder for people to monetize their feeds. Like the slightest little thing on YouTube will get them buried in the algorithm. And there's just a bunch of hoops that they have to jump through. And they are kind of future-proofing themselves so that, you know, their revenue streams don't go away if YouTube and Twitch become completely untenable. I completely understand that. But why would you want to join? If you join the service, you get access to the shows the day after they were live. So that's about a week before they show up on YouTube. Or if you subscribe to the podcast, it's a week before that. They have a show called The Cooldown, which is literally them just kind of sitting there for 15 minutes after the game is over, doing the thing that most of us do after a game where you just sit there and go, I can't believe I did that. That was so dumb. You know, where you just sit there and kind of mull over everything that just happened during the game session. It's kind of fun to watch. There are separate RSS feeds for podcasts for the various shows and campaigns. And there is also a site posting Critical Role Abridged, which is an edited version of the regular episodes that are 60 to 90 minutes long. This is something I don't know if people that haven't been able to get into Critical Role will want to spend the money, but I think a lot of people that have been wanting to get into Critical Role are really going to like this, because I will say, even as somebody that listens to the podcast version and listens to the whole, you know, 4-hour thing while I'm doing other things at work, listening to the 60 to 90 minute abridged versions, I pick up so much more, because it's just, they cut out a lot of the stuff where they're where they're rolling and they're like doing math in their heads and, you know, the things that we normally do, but we're not there. So they have about 15 episodes or so up through campaign 3 so far. I've really liked listening to it that way. This includes shows like Candela Obscura, Midst, and the Daggerheart playtest episodes. The service is $5.99 a month, or it's $59.99 if you get a yearly subscription. So it's basically 2 months free if you do yearly.
The cheap streaming service.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, if you are frustrated with other streaming services, get things like Dropout and this and be happy. That's We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like
Pandas Talking Games, queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Pandas Phil and Senda every other Wednesday, answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your games.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.